Then he said about 10,000 years ago, with the advent of agriculture, we went into what he called the social milieu. That is when the primary relationships were social. And most of our laws, most of our great literature, most of the things that we think of as Western history and much of the history of the rest of the world hadn't happened in the social milieu. But here's where a little takes off from the others. He says that actually in the last 100 years or so, we've entered another milieu, which he calls the technological milieu. I call it the technosphere. And his point was that if you actually look at modern, and this would be in the so-called developing world, I remember, by the way, in that first global warming conference that in my introduction they talked about, it was actually C-SPAN. We had about 50 people from around the world, and C-SPAN was televising it. And everyone was talking about the developing world and the undeveloped world, the developing world and the undeveloped world, you know? And finally, Dr. Vandana Shiva, who's somebody I recommend to all of you, by the way, if you do not know her work or her person, she is fantastic, one of my great inspirations in this world. She got up and said, wait a minute, you know, in a very short time, you, the developed world, have taken the world to the brink of ecological catastrophe with global warming. My people in India, we lived in homeostasis with our environment for thousands and thousands of years. So for the rest of this conference, we'll call where I live the developed world, and where you are the undeveloped world. And there was this awkward silence, and we did it for like week and a half. It was fantastic. But having said that, in the undeveloped world now, you get what I'm saying, us, we live in a technological milieu. If you add the amount of time, or if I add the amount of time I spend in front of my computer, on my telephone, right, in my car, in an artificial environment, including this one, by the way, and the amount of mediation that technology plays in my life, most of my relationships are not what Barbara and Cormac were telling you, with other people or the earth. It's with some technological device or another. And I'm not just talking about the machines, the interlocking number of machines that have taken over for tools and run our society. I'm also talking about the huge technocracies it takes to run them. We're not just talking about nuclear power plant. We're talking about the massive bureaucracies, corporate and government, that run them. And we work for them. Many of the students here will be working for those corporations. And I would note, by the way, that almost all those, there's not a single technocracy I know that isn't a dictatorship. So I find it interesting we call ourselves a democracy, and yet the vast majority of us work in dictatorships for our entire work lives. Just leave that for the moment. But in this technosphere, right, our greatest threats are from technology. The juggernaut and the threat of Armageddon when I was a kid through nuclear technology was the greatest threat when I was growing up. I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis, these things. And now we have global warming. Our greatest threats are from the technosphere, no longer from nature. Yes, there's a hurricane here, tornado here. But basically our greatest fears, and also our dreams, our techno dreams. And some of them have been realized, the dreams of flying, the dreams of antibiotics. But we now think that it's through stem cells or through other miracle technologies. And I recently saw a show, a very serious show on CNN, how we will be the last generation to die, according to several major scientists. So even immortality now has become a product of the technosphere. And I think it's terribly important to realize that also so many young people are in this technological cocoon, where almost everything they do is being mediated through these technological systems and these technological entrancements and entertainments. And that makes us autistic to the cries of the forest that's being cut down, or to the fate of 10 billion animals we use for our food animals every year in unspeakable cruelty, because we are so in our technosphere that becomes something that's outside of it. Now, what happened when you had the technological milieu after the social milieu and the natural milieu? It isn't just sequential. Here's what Jacques Ellul says. I'm going to read this. The technological environment could not exist if it did not find its support and resources in the natural world, nature, and the society. But it eliminates the natural as a milieu. It eliminates the natural as a milieu, supplanting it while wasting and exhausting it. So we don't just set up an ersatz environment. Anybody's been to a mall, one of these large malls, knows it's an ersatz environment. But that very environment is actually exhausting and supplanting the natural world. And that is the world that we've been progressively going into for over 100 years. And I think one of the major reasons that we have grown so autistic. And the legal profession has been basically turned into a technological, what did you call it, Cormac, a cog in the little machine tinkering? So much of our profession has been involved. I was in a corporate law firm for a couple of years, and so much of the tinkering we did was within that technological milieu. And there's some ethical issues, I think, that very unique ethical issues that come from that. One of the facts is that most of, I'm not, as a person who is has attended numerous, many, many masses in my life. Almost all the sermons have to do with individual sin. Individual, you know, lust, individual violence, individual greed. We can go through the seven deadlies and our individual things. I think the technological year, we see the global warming, whether it be hunger, whether it be desolation of the planet, whether it be desertification, whether it be endangered species, do not come from individual backsliding. They're systemic. You see, the real evil that comes from a technological system is systemic. As the theologian Edward Schulze, he says, whereas only a few centuries ago, evil, so-called, had to be considered pertinent to moral behavior, more specifically the backsliding or weakness of the individual, today it also appears in a manner detached from the individual. It shows up impersonally in arrangements and conditions of social, industrial, technical, and general life, which admittedly are created and tolerated by man. It appears anonymously as injustice or hardship, an interpersonal realm where nobody seems directly liable or responsible. Do we even know the names of the heads of the corporations that are causing global warming right now? And also this evil takes place at an amazing distance. You know, people who are eating the McDonald's Happy Meal, they're not there in the slaughterhouse to see what's going on. They're not there to see the destruction of the grazing lands and the parks. They're not there to see the fires destroying the forests and the animals fleeing from them. They're detached. So I've called this cold, because, you know, a synonym for distance is cold. So I call this cold evil. There's a wonderful thing. I don't know if you ever read a book called Computer Power and Human Reasoning by Joseph Weizenbaum. I recommend it to you. It's a very good book on computers. But he was a Defense Department consultant in the Vietnam War days. And he helped sort of do a computer-based massive bombing strategy. And this is what he said afterwards. These men, and actually includes himself, were able to give the counsel they gave about this distance bombing because they were operating at an enormous psychological distance from the people who would be maimed and killed by the weapons systems that would result from the ideas they communicated to their sponsors. The lesson, therefore, is the scientists and technologists must, by acts of will and imagination, actively strive to reduce such psychological distances, to counter the forces that tend to remove him from the consequences of his actions. So the technological milieu also has enormous ethical implications for our religions, for our theological thinking. But there's no doubt that the technological milieu is in trouble. That's why we're here. Over the last little bit with this genre of global environmental threats and global warming, right? Ozone depletion, all the things that we all know so well, it's become very clear that the technological milieu is not consistent with a sustainable nature, right? As a matter of fact, it's wasting it, as Jacques Ellul pointed out. And I knew that, and a lot of us knew that 20 or 30 years ago, and that's why we said we're going to have to devolve our technology so it benefits life systems. E.F. Schumacher was a great prophet in this. Small is beautiful. If you haven't read it, run, do not walk. Get it? It's fantastic. And he predicted this. And he said, listen, since the technological milieu is not consistent with the natural milieu, and we all need the natural milieu to survive, it is the basis for our survival, inevitably we will devolve the technologies and the technological systems and technocracies around us so they fit the natural world. We will do that. We will do that. We have to, otherwise we won't survive. And so we assume we would inherit the future as this became more and more evident. I did. But we were wrong. You see, we thought that was inevitable. What we did not realize is that those who were creating this entire technological milieu and who were profiting from it had something else in mind. They said, let's not devolve our technologies or change our economy to fit nature. What about changing nature so it fits our technological and economic system? Let's not change technologies. After all, we're kind of addicted to this technology. You know, we can't live with it. Now we know we can't live without it. So let's try and change nature to fit that. And I would argue that the advances in some of the things I work on every day, biotechnology and nanotechnology, are actually the attempt to change nature so it fits our current technological system. A couple of examples. We now know that global warming may cause droughts, so some of our biotechnology companies are saying we're going to create plants that are drought resistant. Now, let's not get rid of global warming. We'll just change life so it fits a new global warming world. Let's not change our technologies to creating this catastrophe. We'll just change everything that's affected by them so they fit it. There's a Purdue University just did studies. Apparently, the horrible fate of egg layer hens in our factory farm system, right? They are put in these cages, battery cages. I don't know how many of you have seen that. It's really horrifying, but apparently they still need to brood, right? This is, after all, their children, right? So they need to brood. So that's a real problem. It creates stress and it creates inefficiency in battery hens. So Purdue University, they said, let's try and find the genetic component of motherhood in these hens and remove it so they will better fit the factory farm system. So let's not change the factory farm system, let these hens have free range and actually exhibit their natural behavior. Let's change them so they better fit the factory farm system. And almost all genetically engineered plants, 81% of all genetically engineered plants in the world today are there for one reason alone. They've been engineered so they can withstand massive, massive doses of herbicide. Normally, if you spray herbicide on the weeds and it gets on your crops, you kill the crops too. And that's inconvenient for chemical companies, particularly as the weeds get more and more resistant to our known herbicides. They want to spray more and more herbicides on it. So they said, let's not reduce our herbicides and reduce the resistance of weeds to herbicide. Let's alter the fundamental genetic components of plants so they can resist massive amounts of this herbicide. So as a result, 150 million more tons of herbicide have been poured on our croplands in the 7 years we've had massive growing of genetically engineered crops. And by the way, we have not escaped this. One of the great things about the technological milieu is there is no arrogance of the human. No. If you look at the massive destruction, I mean, untold destruction of humans in the technological wars of the 20th century, they've been slaughtered with the same impunity that we've slaughtered nature. If you look at the workers who were eaten up, men and women, in the technological industrial system, they were not privileged over the coal and the products that they were helping manufacture. And in my time, certainly, I have seen with the sale of fetal tissue, the sale of mother's wombs and surrogate motherhood, the exact same economic and technological things we've used on the animals we've used on women. Some of the battles I fought legally. And actually, if you look at what we've done in patent law, I don't know how many either patent lawyers are here or budding patent lawyers are here, but you'll note since 1980, we've changed the patent law. Under Section 101 of the patent law, you can patent only machines, manufacturers, or an inventor's composition of matter. For the 200 years since Thomas Jefferson had that law passed, early history of our country, it never referred to nature, because nature wasn't a machine or manufacturer or inventor's composition of matter. Since 1980 and throughout the Reagan administration, that changed. Now you can patent plants, microbes, plants, animals, human genes, human cells, and fetuses. And they've all been patented as manufacturers and machines. So this technological mindset has invaded our law and ultimately even changed the way we think of life. So I had to put it to you that we are in a very dramatic moment indeed, where either the technological milieu, and I don't think it will be successful, I'm just worried about the extraordinary devastation it will cause, is trying to actually change life through nanotechnology, biotechnology, a number of other things, synthetic biology, to fit this dream, this technological dream. And the web of nature, I'm not sure. I know it will survive, but I worry, as I did with nuclear Armageddon, exactly what it will look like after these folks are done with it. And I would note also, and this is, I'm just throwing this out because it's something I've been thinking about lately, that I think behind this is a pseudo-religion. I think there's a pseudo-unconscious theology behind this. It's sort of immanentizing the eschaton. It's this belief that there is linear progress, that we're going to have a heaven on earth, and that science, with a capital S, and I have nothing against science properly used, is very important, as Rachel, people who saw the Rachel Carson show last night realized. But science with a capital S, when it's hypostasis, when it becomes a person, science tells us that the reason that you feel fear is some synaptic thing in your brain. You go, I didn't know that. I thought it was because I get afraid, you know. Science, in 400 years, and Barbara was talking about this, separated quantitative from the qualitative. So if you ask me, Andy, tell me about your daughter, and I say, well, let's see, she's 5'8" and a half, she weighs about 120 pounds, she's mostly water, some potassium. You go, what? That's not your daughter. But that's what they did 400 years ago. They split the quantitative with the qualitative. And that's the basis of the scientific method. There's a very limited truth to it, but very limited. Very important, but very limited. And the same, science, however, was a little bit, if science is the father, if it's all-knowing, if it's going to get us there, how does it incarnate itself? Who is the new sun? It's technology. I mean, Christ walked on water, but we now have jet skis. Let's get real. And technology performs those everyday miracles. It's got me down here in an airplane. Right? I was terrified my child was ill of the antibiotics. Technology becomes the incarnated sun based on efficiency. Right? Efficiency is the basis of all technology. It's the ideal for all machines. Minimum input, minimum time for maximum output. Great. But what if I told you that's how I treat my kids? Minimum input of affection and love, minimum time for maximum output of good grades. Right? No one treats anything they love efficiently, do they? What do we treat the things we love with? Love, right? And the third thing is the market, competition. Right? That is why we get up every morning, to buy. That's what Barbara was talking about. Right? The consumption. That's the Holy Spirit. That's the paraclete that comes down through millions of advertisements, through untold hours, encouraging us to partake in the science and technological system. Now we know in every trinity, science, God, incarnated in the technology that visits us in everyday miracles, and the paraclete that gets the enthusiasm every day to participate in this, there has to be a hidden fourth. And the Christian tradition usually uses the devil. The hidden fourth, I think, in this is nature, in this trinity, because nature's limits gets us old, gets us ill, has limits on what we can do. And the dreams of the tomorrow makers and nanotechnology, biotechnology, always say we have to conquer nature. So this is, I think, what we're up against. This is from my lens, admittedly, but I think the technological milieu, its attempt to remake nature in this image and this unconscious theology behind it that is substituted for any other trinity that we can come up with its cold, efficient things of quantitative analysis, efficiency, and the market supply and demand and competition. And by the way, if you're a heretic to any of those three, and I am to all three, you are treated with the same disdain and dismissal that a heretic would have been treated in the Middle Ages. Just try it. Many of you, I'm sure, already have. Just try it. So I just wanted to give you that view of what I think we're up against here. This is not a simple issue. It's not just we can reform things. I think we have a systemic issue, a very difficult one at hand. So how can law address this? When you're in a hole, stop digging. Well, the first thing, I think, is to stop the bleeding. Stop the technological milieu from its destruction of nature. And I think that's the role of so many of us in environmental law. There's a case that you may want to know about. It's Geertsen, G-E-E-R-T-S-O-N, v. Johann. Several decisions last year. For the very first time, we got a federal judge in the Ninth Circuit. This is through the Center for Food Safety, my organization. We filed on behalf of farmers saying that you have genetically engineered alfalfa out there that is resistant to the herbicide, the one I was just telling you about. It will pollute organic and conventional alfalfa with its genes. And that's unacceptable. It has to be halted under the National Environment Policy Act because it's a major federal program that impacts the environment. We got a judge to agree with us, Judge Breyer in the Ninth Circuit. He halted all sale and all planting of that. And it's funny, it wasn't just the economic harm to the organic farmers. Actually, that was secondary. The first thing was that the organic alfalfa and other alfalfas have the right not to be invaded by this foreign genetic material. So under the National Environment Policy Act, under the Endangered Species Act, we already have laws. Not enough of them, admittedly, but we already have the beginning, a beachhead, where we're saying nature is understood as something that has its own intrinsic rights. It cannot solely be treated as means. It is an end in of itself that has the right of its own integrity. So I think that, we stop the bleeding in that manner, and I think that case is a very good example of how that can happen even under the current environment, the current regime. You know, there's an old Native American story. It's about a group of women who are doing their laundry in a river, and they see a baby floating down the river. And they run out and they save the baby. They say, oh my God, this baby almost drowned. They save the baby. And they look upstream and there's two babies coming down the river. Oh man, dash into the river to save two babies. Three babies now down the river. Dashing. More and more babies come flying down this river. They have to save them. They're just in constant motion saving these babies. After a little while, the chief comes up and she says, maybe we should go upstream and see who's throwing the babies in the river. And I think this is the double job of all of us. Is we need to stop the bleeding. We need to stop this technological milieu from its appropriation and expropriation and wasting and destruction of nature. Because that's what it's about. That's what it's about. It lives. But we also need to change the consciousness that's behind that. We need to alter the consciousness that is doing this. Because even if everybody in this room that is not an environmental attorney were to be that tomorrow, there would not be enough of us to halt all of the GMOs, all the nanotechnology, all of the cement factories, all the destruction of our rivers and our wetlands. Just won't be enough of us. So our double job is, I know it's hard enough to do the first, I admit, I mean, God knows, but our double job is, how can we begin to change the consciousness that's behind that? And again, fortunately, I think that we have something at our disposal. This is both true of the Catholic tradition and the Western law tradition that is a real help to us here. And that's the natural law tradition. And I know this may be shocking to those who think of the natural law having to do with Justice Bork or Scalia. How in the world could this possibly help us in our current circumstance? What is Kimbrell thinking? And by the way, it's kind of interesting. You know, Cormac referred to that wonderful expression of Father Thomas Berry, and in full transparency here, I should say that Father Thomas Berry is my teacher, and my mentor. He also baptized me, and is also the godfather of my children. So he's obviously had an enormous effect on my life. But that wonderful thing, he says that, you know, the industrial age turned life from a commune of subjects into a collection of objects. And Scott Buchanan says, yes, we used to have goods, and now we have goods. We used to have goods, any ethical goods, and viewing all of nature as a given good, and now we have commodities, goods to sell, from goods to goods. And by the way, same with trust, saving, bond. Think how those terms have changed through this technological mirror from what they used to mean to what they now mean. Interesting. But one of the most important things that's changed is the concept of natural law. How do we get natural law? Well, as anybody knows from our Declaration of Independence, Bill of Rights, Constitution, our founding fathers were actually ersatz Romans. They loved Roman law. They gave themselves Roman nom de plumes, as you probably know if you've read the Federalist Papers. Right? They loved natural law. And the Declaration of Independence says we have unalienable rights given to us by nature and nature's God. We're given those rights. We don't have to earn them, but we're given them. And that's the fundamental nature of natural law from the Roman time. They took it directly from Roman law. And Roman law said nothing can be treated solely as a means. It has to also be treated as an end in itself. And they got this from Plato and Aristotle that Barbara was talking about, where they said everything on earth has an eidos, an idea, an essence that makes it what it is. There's a reason that the eel is what it is and the salmon is what it is. Chihuahua and a Great Dane. Each has a different idea. Cheney and Obama. Each has a different idea. Couldn't resist. And also has a telos, has a meaning within the whole, that relationship that Cormac and Barbara were talking about. So everything has this idea, and that idea then works in a telos, has its own meaning. And they said, our laws have to protect the essence of each thing so it's not destroyed, and its meaning within the whole, eidos and telos. That's the basis of natural law. Well, wait a minute. We know through the industrial age, we took human nature and put it one place, and the rest of nature, non-rational in the human sense of that word, and what do we call non-rational nature? Natural resources. Once you've used that word, you've already lost the argument. Right? And by the way, they now call us human resources. So again, we're getting pushed in here. I disagree with some of my environmental friends. They say, oh, you know, arrogant humans. I go, you haven't been listening. You haven't been watching. We're getting crunched up just like the rest of nature. You know, technology is a hammer that doesn't just break nature, it breaks us. 60 million of us every day take psychotropic medication to get through the day. 80 million people, and I'm going to raise my hand on this one, take some psychotropic medication to get through the night. We're not just changing the biochemistry of the planet, we're changing the biochemistry of humanity. 7 million of our children in the United States take psychotropic medication to get through their school day. And 500,000, and this is one thing Hillary Clinton has spoken out on, 500,000 of our children under the age of 3 are on psychotropic medication to get through their days. So again, the fact that we're arrogant humans, we are changing our own biochemistry so we fit the rhythms of this technological system. We're not changing the technological system to fit human nature and what we need spiritually and psychologically. We're changing our very chemistry so we don't get too depressed. We can speed up. We can fit the system. So don't think that we're somehow above being chewed up in this. We're definitely not. But what happened with natural law is it was extremely inconvenient for the industrial age. So what they did was, and this Immanuel Kant did this, basically they said, actually, natural law only applies to humans. We have unalienable rights. We're the ones that are given. this privilege of never being viewed solely as a means, but as an ends. And that is very important they did that. If you look at the prescriptions against torture, you look at the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, if you look at the history of the labor movement, it was this sense that we have an unalienable right not to be exploited in this fashion. The abolition of slavery. It was terribly important that they did this. Otherwise, the industrial age would have been even more devastating than it was to humanity. Here are the maxims. Here's the maxims of natural law. By the way, I got this from the Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage. They define natural law. Historically, a number of senses have been attributed to the term. Today, the prevailing sense, especially in legal context, is natural law is that which determines what is right and wrong and has the power or is valid by virtue of nature. Hence, everywhere and always. That's legal usage today. And there's three formulations, and I'm liberally borrowing from old Immanuel Kant on this and sort of changing him. He's rolling somewhere. But the first maxim is for legislators and judges. And it says, you need to choose the maxims of your legal acts as if they were to serve as universal laws of nature. You have to choose, if you're a legislator or a judge, your decision should be based on the fact that this decision has to comport with the universal laws of nature. And now we don't just add our theological views to that. Some of us still feel strongly that, you know, purpose, intention, and design are there in that beautiful ordering that Barbara was talking about. But you don't even need that necessarily to follow this. You just simply say ecology. That's the rules of the game that Cormac was talking about, that we got to, if we don't play with, we're out. So that's the first formulation. The second is for philosophers and legal teachers, maybe a few in this room. All maxims, again, legal concepts, ought to, by their own legislation, harmonize with the understanding of life as a kingdom of ends. And that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about recovering the kingdom of nature as a communion of subjects with legal rights. And then the third is for all of us, and this is my favorite, each natural thing must be treated as an end in itself and not merely as a means. And that's for all of us practitioners. So what does this mean? When I was younger and we saw the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson and others, there was a small group of people in Chicago that were sticking to the free market ideas. You know, those ideas that self-interest somehow was the invisible hand of God. To me, one of the more bizarre ideas in modern philosophy, but one that's been extremely contagious. And that's, I think at odds with the Christian tradition, but... Von Hayek, Milton Friedman, some of the people may have read these folks. And they decided, you know, we're not going to change normative laws. We are going to change the minds of those who make the laws, the judges, the legislators, the lawyers. We are going to say, you know what? Free market supply and demand is a natural law in itself. Now, of course, nothing in nature reproduces based on human supply and demand, but they didn't worry about the rest of nature. And Norman Posner, for instance, a very, very recognized judge on the surrogate motherhood, I did a lot of litigation against surrogate motherhood, against the contracting for children. He said, why shouldn't we have children by supply and demand? Some people can't have them. They should be able to buy them. Some people can make a bunch of them. Why shouldn't they be able to sell them? Why did he say that? Why did he rule that way? Because the Chicago School, over years and years and years and decades, had given this idea. So natural law is not normative law. It's not statutes. It's what's behind those who make the statutes, behind those that make the common law. So what I'm recommending here is that natural law, these maxims, particularly that nothing can be treated merely as means, as ends, this is what we need to do through our law reviews, this is what we need to do through our work, get this in the minds. With the environmental crisis before, this is an amazingly important moment in legal history where we can make that the consciousness that's informing laws. And with the Supreme Court decision and the Ninth Circuit case, I can begin to see it's already happening for all the great work that you're doing and a lot of us are doing. It's already happening, but we need to be more specific. We need to be more direct in saying this is exactly what we're talking about. And nothing can be treated solely as means, because that's what the technological milieu does. The entire point of the technological milieu is to change things from a community of things, a community of subjects to a collection of objects that can be exploited, patented, and used. So our greatest defense against that is to change the consciousness and say, no, nothing is merely means. We are all ends with an eidos and with a telos. In that regard, there's a couple of concepts I want to throw at you, just because this is, after all, law school. I think that the thing that I've seen, and Joseph Sachs did a great article on this in 1970. People may be familiar with Joseph Sachs, the wonderful environmental scholar, law scholar. It's a public trust doctrine. The public trust doctrine is amazing. It says that all natural, it could say, that all of nature can only be used in such a fashion that its essential character and function, eidos and telos, is not altered. And this actually has been applied to water law, right? Because we need water for navigation. So you cannot so exploit a river or a bay that it would lose its function and its character. So I think the public trust doctrine is very, has been a lot of, you can, when you look it up, you'll see a lot of articles relating it to natural law. I think the public trust doctrine is a terribly important concept if we're going to take this concept into real law, real life law. The second I would recommend, and this had to do with what Cormack was saying, a tree cannot, I mean, people say, Andy, come on, and, you know, like, tree's going to walk into court. What's that about? It doesn't have agency, right? That's the term we use. You have to have agency to be recognized under the law, right? Well, wait a minute. Anybody here familiar with family law, right? A two-year-old, a baby, even a 10-year-old doesn't have agency, right? In divorce. So who do they go with? How do they decide to do it? What do? They appoint a guardian ad litem. That's what they do. And the guardian ad litem's sole job is to represent the interests of the child. So what I'm suggesting is we have a guardian ad litem for nature. Of course the tree can't speak for itself, but we can speak for it. And an ecologist can come in and say, hey, this ecosystem depends on this and this and this and this, and I'm here in a dispute over the use of this mountain, or dispute over this river, or dispute over alfalfa. I'm here to represent the interests, the sole interests of that ecosystem or that element of the ecosystem. The third is, quickly, is citizen suit provisions. We have this in the Clean Water Act. But each of us, remember that third maxim, should treat nature solely, not solely, but primarily as an ends and not as a means. So when we see that not happening, we should have the right to go to court on this. So anyway, here I'm going to finish with this. So how will this affect us? I wrote this out this morning, so I stumbled through this. Bear with me. Brian Brown, another student of Father Thomas Berry, has suggested this a while back. So this morning I wrote out the Declaration of Independence a little differently. Remember I said the Declaration of Independence reflected that changing of natural laws that only fit humans and not the rest of nature? Well, what if we wrote it a little bit differently? What if we wrote the Declaration of Independence so that if this real natural law concept that would see all of nature as a kingdom of nature imbued with that imago Dei? So I call it the Declaration of Interdependence. And here's what I try to change as few words as possible. So this is only partially tongue-in-cheek, folks. Okay, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for all people to affirm the inherent bonds which have connected them with all beings and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them, a decent respect to the opinions of humankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to separate from any nation or system of laws not based in the interbeing of the earth community. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all beings are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the capacity to realize their destiny within the integral community of all other beings. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among humans, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these protections, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect the integrity and welfare of all beings. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established shall not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that humankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing their forms of government to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce life in all of its diverse fullness into an absolute despotism, it is their right, no, it is their duty to throw off such government and such tyranny, and to provide safeguards for the future security of all life forms. Such has been the patient suffering of the earth communities, and such is now the necessity which constrains the human to alter their forms and systems of government and laws. The history of the present alienation of the human from the non-human members of the earth community is a history of repeated usurpations and tyrannies and injuries. and having the direct object of the establishment of an absolute tyrannical domination over nature. This is the ruin of the community of all animate and inanimate beings on the planet, and this can no longer be tolerated. Thank you.
That was Andrew Kimbrell, director of the International Center for Technology Assessment, author of Your Right to Know, Genetic Engineering and the Secret Changes to Your Food. We'll conclude with questions and answers with the panelists. There were actually three panelists, more than this two-hour slot allowed. The third, whose voice you'll hear during the Q&A, is Barbara Wall, Associate Professor of Philosophy, Villanova University, and founding editor of Journal for Peace and Justice Studies, focusing on Catholic social thought.
I'd like to thank the speakers for their contribution to our effort here to be rethinking law and governance for the sake of the planet. And I'm going to begin this dialogue with a question, and then I'm going to follow that with opening the floor to our audience for the questions that you've jotted down. Poet Gerald Manley Hopkins wrote, "Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, for all things counter, original, spare, strange." With this frame, I'd like to ask this question of our morning panel. Is the development of Earth jurisprudence better served by a single overarching legal and moral language, such as natural law, or by a plurality of legal and moral languages? Would anyone like to field this, either Cormac or Barbara, since Andy just spoke? And we do have the microphone on the table.
I think there may be many answers to this. When I was trying to write Wild Law, I was grappling with this question, and because if you look at nature, as reflected in the Gerald Manley Hopkins poem, it's diverse. It seems that there's an inherent tendency in the universe to diversify and to manifest itself in increasingly diverse and beautiful forms. But at the same time, despite the diversity, it maintains that inherent coherence and wholeness. So it seems to me that most of our legal systems work on the basis of uniformity and imposing uniformity, and that tends to destroy diversity and to some extent is working against the grain of nature. So the way I tried to resolve it was by saying that there's something fundamental and inherent in nature which I call the great jurisprudence. In other words, it's just the way things are. It's not a question of right or wrong. Other cultures have different names for this kind of thing. But there's a fundamental basis of how the universe works with which one just has to accept. But there are many ways of translating the great jurisprudence into legal philosophies, which I refer to as earth jurisprudence, because it is possible to interpret those fundamental principles in different ways, and indeed in many ways it's often very important to do that. In other words, you need to be culturally appropriate translations and place-specific translations. So the way in which those fundamental principles manifest itself need not necessarily be the same in every place. So I think the answer is kind of a bit of both. It is necessary to maintain a degree of coherence. You can't have anything being okay as an earth jurisprudence. It does have to be consistent with what I call the great jurisprudence. But having said that, it's also equally important to allow diversity to develop and for it to be slightly different in different places. So it's a kind of unity in diversity, is how I see it.
Well, first of all, I think that Hopkins' poem, Pied Beauty, is extraordinary in that it's trying to reveal through the way in which he couldn't even use ordinary expressions. He coined phrases to kind of give this explosive sense of the extraordinary experience of the beauty of the natural world. And it's beyond language in a way. I mean, he was frustrated. You could almost see the frustration of trying to use human language to express this extraordinary experience that ordinary words just didn't suffice. So that goes back to the experiential context of being drawn in and engaged in a way that's you just can't read on a page. And that incarnational sense that if you really, really, really believe just one thing about our tradition, just one thing, that God has literally touched and is present in all of creation. Forget everything else. Don't quote me on that. That sense in which I think if we just believe that one thing, it could make an enormous difference in how we behave. The second thing is, in terms of natural law, I don't know that we need... my initial reaction was, I don't know that we need more different discourses on it, because they're already oftentimes talking at cross purposes to each other, even within the same discipline. But I think maybe if we could get to a fundamental understanding of what theories have predominated or prevailed and why, what's at the root. For example, if you take a Lockean notion of property, what is natural about Locke's understanding of property? Mm-hmm. And if you then take a Hobbesian view of what constitutes nature, or someone like Aquinas or others, and looking at what are the underlying assumptions about the concept of nature that gives rise to a whole political system, a whole way of thinking, a whole language about rights, etc. I think we might be better served to realize that when anyone uses this language, we have to go back and re-examine and get to the foundational concepts that are invested in this way of thinking about the world. So that if you have a difficulty often with the theory up here, I think we have to go to the foundations of that theory. How do they, what do they think about nature and human nature in relationship to nature? Then I think we have some way of understanding why and how they treat the rest of the world the way they do. And that's only at that level, I think, that maybe we can argue or discuss with each other in a way that we can come to maybe, hopefully, some commonalities of seeing where this particular view has led us in a more destructive path. And this particular view perhaps could be more constructive or restorative, and at least lay open the possibilities of which way we want to go. But I think you have to do that kind of foundational work, because we do have problems with language.
Thank you. Yeah, Andy, do you want to briefly say something?
Real quick, you know, I think one of the problems that we often have, or I often have, is, you know, none of us are on top of this mountain, you know, particularly in the technological system. We're complicit, and almost everybody here is complicit in the crimes in the ecocide that we're talking about. I know I am. So I think it's very important that we not talk at people, but that we share with them that we're not just in an environmental crisis, we're in a moral crisis. Mm-hmm. And that each of us together, working together in relationship, have to do something to resolve that moral crisis, whether it be as lawyers or economists or any of what Thomas Berry calls the four great disciplines, education, religion. And I think the way to do that, it reminds me of the old Cardinal Newman idea of reverence. You know, that we find all of us where we are. We don't try and lecture somebody to a point where they're not. And so I think some of the concepts, the reason maybe natural law is useful, but many other concepts, depending on the legal culture, is that, you bring to the discussion something that a large number of people either agree with or at least can talk about. So many of our most conservative, social conservative people are very strong believers, especially in the Catholic tradition, in natural law. So instead of election, you don't understand Gaia, or you don't understand this, or you don't understand what's really happening, but to approach them through that is a beautiful thing, and it's done a tremendous amount for the protection of humans. And can we talk about amplifying? That way we approach reverence, we can learn from them, and they can learn from us. So I think there is an advantage, whatever legal culture you're in, is to take what's already there and to take those who seem to be in opposition to us and with reverence approach this as a commonality. I'm not disagreeing, I'm just amplifying on what they're saying.
Very good, thank you. Now, questions from the audience. Do any of you all have any questions? Right up there, go ahead.
Does the postmodernist have a leg to stand on at all? Would you care to comment, given the great criticism of natural law as the basis of establishing a normative ethic, how do we respond to an argument that would say that in fact meaning, chaos, is not inherent within the object but is socially constructed and is interpreted in the context of relationships of people in community? How do you respond to that? Is that a direction that would end up discrediting? I guess what I'm trying to say, are we milking natural law theory because it intuitively sounds like it's more supportive of the environment? Or could we get just as much mileage out of in processes of democracy through civic discourse and the development of meaning as much respect for a normative ethics based on processes of dialogue and based on relationships with people in the context of their neighborhoods and their communities and in nature? Help me frame that question out.
And I will repeat that. Are we milking natural law beyond its utility? And could we better frame ourselves within a civic discourse, a civic relational discourse, to get to the same normative ends? One of you like to feel that?
Very good question. I love postmodernism, frankly. I think it's a tremendous enzyme that breaks down accretions of ideas and thoughts that have lost their dynamism. I think that's the purpose of many of these ideas, not that they're necessarily the truth, but rather they perform a wonderful function in our intellectual and consciousness history, and I think postmodernism does that, and I'm very fond of it. My son's even more fond of it than I am. But I think there is an issue. I think... And I don't think that excludes. I think it's part of the discussion, definitely. And I think relationships and socially constructed meaning, you know, is absolutely... I mean, I think you can come to some of the very same conclusions from that point of view using, for instance, ecology and evolutionary biology, for example, where I might have some issues. But I think you can come to similar points of view. However, I would challenge you a little bit, because I was challenged this way. Frederick Turner, the philosopher, challenged me this way. He's a good friend and he's a wonderful poet. And he said, Andy, the Buick is one kind of a system, and the river is another kind of a system. I see no basis for distinguishing between the two. They each have socially constructed meanings. So why are you so interested in, you know, protecting the river from changes when you wouldn't be saying we shouldn't modernize the Buick? So that was the challenge I would throw back.
Thank you. Another question. Oh, excuse me. Barbara, go right ahead.
Thanks for jumping in there. As a philosopher, I guess I really should respond to this. But it's an excellent question. It's one that we all struggle with. And it's true, I think, even as Aquinas said, natural law is changed by addition. But whether or not the very conception of natural law as a socially constructed reality is fruit for much discussion. And I guess... one of my concerns today is that, and I support the ways in which we reimagine the world. I mean, certainly coming, I say to many of our students, we have questions today like the one you raised that most of us who were trained in philosophy 30, 40 years ago never had. So I have great hope for young people today that have questions that come out of human rights concerns, feminist reconceptions, et cetera, et cetera. Those are extraordinary contributions to the way we can see the world better, understand the world, to see the ways in which perhaps oppressive ideologies have worked that have been more destructive than helpful in terms of the flourishing of any one person or certainly of the world. One of the questions and concerns I have today with regard to a purely deconstructionist model is that we have the tendency, and particularly in the academy, quite frankly, to take everything apart. And we leave our students often with nothing positive or constructive in its place. We're great at taking things down, right? But we're not very good at putting anything in place. And it has a withering effect on many of our students, that we leave them in a kind of almost despair with nothing constructive. And I think particularly, you know, even with the environment, you can wither any audience for in 10 minutes or in days with an overwhelming list. And what do you put in its place? What's reconstructive about that? So that's my concern in the academy, that we begin to examine that more holistically, if you will. And I think even if you go back to Benedict's speech at Regensburg, which, you know, has a number of problems, but at any rate, one of the things he was trying to say is that what the world needs today in the academy can offer is an open-ended discourse between faith and reason. Not faith that is reduced to personal piety, not to diminish personal piety, but faith can't be the sum total of that. And reason can't be reduced to a positive, analytical, quantitative analysis of the earth. That there's got to be something more in both of those. And that the academy is the place where hopefully the ways in which faith can inform reason and reason inform faith, that is what is healthy and that is what is needed in the world in a creative, constructive fashion. I'm sorry that message didn't get out as well as the other messages. But I think that that's true, that we have to look at certainly what contemporary understanding of the world provides us, but also the ways in which we can move beyond destructive tendencies to more constructive, restorative ways of being present in the world. And to do that as a community, in dialogue with each other, is an extraordinary gift, I think, that the Academy can offer.
Okay. This gentleman right here.
Jack Griffin, I'm a member of the Florida Bar for St. Louis County. My question is, shouldn't we be focusing in on different means of finding standing to fight some of the atrocious environmental calamities that we see every day? For instance, some trees do have standing. They have standing through the guardian ad litem situation or parents' patriae type of theory, by the county governments who have written into their codes, you can't cut a tree down that is so many inches in diameter. So shouldn't we focus more on developing standing so we can fight these in our system as it's been here for 200 years?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the question is about standing. Shouldn't we amplify our current principles about standing and where we have seedlings already embedded in city and county codes?
No, yes, I think develop more or less legislation, push it that way so that you can walk into court, say, in California and argue for the organic alfalfa growers. Genetically altering this alfalfa is going to cause this great harm. I'm not sure if that was the argument or not the case.
Okay. So we're asking for the amplification of principles of standing. Would either of our lawyers like to field that question?
First of all, yes, 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 yes. That's exactly what we need to be. The strategy for almost 20 years by those who, for whatever reasons, I would have to exercise psychology to better understand it, do not want to pursue the protection of our planet in peril, has been to knock you out on standing. For those lawyers here, I mean, that, you know, Scalia's famous decision, you know, that limited standing having to do with the use of a mountain, he said unless you've actually been on that little section of the mountain and walked up and down it and can show your interest, no one else has standing to sue on this, you know, on this use of it, whether it be a ski resort or whatever. He tried to limit standing. And that's been expanded since then. That was what knocked out my first series of lawsuits on global warming, by the way, that decision. So standing has been the technique, it's been the strategy. By narrowing and narrowing standings, because they know they can't win on the merits. They know that we'll win on the merits. They have only one place to try and knock us out, and that's jurisdictional issues, but particularly standing. So I think if there's one place I would focus, something I just got to the very end on citizen suit standing, which isn't the Clean Water Act. If even just citizen suit provisions were in every one of our environmental laws, that would be enormously helpful. There's just quickly, not to bore the non-lawyers in the group, but we can go on like this forever. Maybe we can do it at lunch. One of the reasons we got almost all of our standing under NEPA was informational standing. Those were organizations, could be including the center, that inform a certain number of people if the failure of a government to do an environmental impact statement or an assessment on a particular environmental program meant that you couldn't give that information to your members, to those people that you got out to. That was enough standing. That's how we got standing throughout the 70s and 80s. So there's a number, and that's actually still alive in the Ninth Circuit, not in the D.C. Circuit anymore. So there are a number of ways we need to expand standing. And I would even love to see standing based on a guardian ad litem basis, or you know, where the actually guardian ad litem can bring standing on behalf of an aspect of nature. So standing, if we don't break the standing barrier, almost all of the statutes that we are going to be trying to be litigating under will not be available to us because we'll never get to the merits. You will never actually get to the merits. That was a huge thing in the global warming case. Thank God Justice Kennedy is a states' rights guy. So when the states came in 2003, we focused the argument on an obscure statute that gives states standing over any other entity. He loved it. And if you read the decision, the standing that we got was for the state of Massachusetts. Now once you get standing for one, the case goes forward in the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court. But we knew that was how they were going to try and knock us out. I told you, that was their theory. If they could say, hey, global warming exists, but no one ever has standing to sue, end of it as a judicial problem. End of it as a legal issue. So I couldn't agree with you more. And I think one of the things I'd love to do, and I'm going to talk to the center about this and any of the law students out there, what we need to do is we need to go around the world. And we need to see all the statutes, all the constitutional provisions, all the cases that give us new access and understanding of standing, and that provide us a view of nature under the law that is not simply protection of nature or human utility, for the integrity of the natural thing itself. We have Endangered Species Act, NEPA, there's play, I'm sure, South Africa, throughout. We don't have that. No one's ever really compiled that. An Earth Jurisprudence Handbook of what's already out there, and standing with which we're where I'd start.
Excellent. Cormac, did you want to respond?
I won't say much, but other than once you know where you want to go, then I think you look at all the different tactics and strategies that you can use, and they'll differ in different systems. And I would agree very much. Standing is one of them. And in South Africa, the Framework Environment Act gives very, very wide standing provisions. So the standing is very seldom an issue in South African environmental law. And that was simply because the system developed much later than here. And that we looked at other countries and saw that most of the cases were being argued around standing instead of the merits. And so we just changed it by legislation. So just really to amplify and agree with what's already been said.
You've been listening to selections from a 2008 symposium, Framing an Earth Jurisprudence for a Planet in Peril, held at Barry University in Orlando, Florida. The featured speakers were Cormac Cullinan from the Republic of South Africa and Andrew Kimbrell from the United States. We'll continue with the conclusion of this series next week. If you missed last week's show or any previous episode of Unwelcome Guests, they're available online at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Like an unwelcome